Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins, NIH is the leading supporter of biomedical research in the world. Would you tell us more about your strategic vision for NIH, and how do the five themes or areas of exceptional opportunity factor into this vision?
When I was asked to come and lead this effort, I spent some time thinking hard about where the areas were that were most ripe for this kind of emphasis, and talked to a lot of other scientists whose opinions I value, and came up with these five themes that seemed exceptionally ready for additional emphasis. They're pretty broad. They cover a lot of what NIH is able to do. One of those is to push the basic science, but inform it by technology, because technology is really advancing in many ways. And perhaps in the past, biologists tended to think of technology as a secondary area of emphasis. These days, it drives so much of what we can do that it deserves its own kind of push. Secondly, we wanted to be sure that opportunities to take basic science and bring it into clinical applications could be speeded up, emphasized, nurtured, encouraged in new ways, what you'd call translational science. Third, because we were at that point when I first came to NIH in the midst of a national discussion about how we're going to revise our own approach to healthcare. NIH, while we're not part of the healthcare delivery system, we are responsible for generating the evidence about what works and what doesn't work. So that also seemed to be a very important theme to emphasize. How could we provide the rigorous research that would enable patients and physicians to know what kind of interventions are going to be available and what's going to help them? Fourth, and maybe this is the one that surprised some people, was global health. I think we no longer live in a world where we can afford to think about the health of the United States in isolation from what's going on elsewhere. All those infectious diseases that pay no attention to country borders are just one example of that. And it's more than that now, with all of the things that are happening in terms of trends in chronic diseases, which cross boundaries as well. And there's lots of opportunities in global health to try to pursue that more vigorously, and lots of young scientists who are interested in that area. So that was the fourth theme. And then finally, and the most critical resource of all, is to support the researchers that are going to be doing the work, and to be sure we have set up a system that recruits the best and the brightest to come and join us from whatever group they represent, and to provide them with a kind of career trajectory that they can feel is worth investing in. Because if we don't have that talent, none of the rest of this will happen.
So, Doctor, before we get into each one of these themes a little bit more, I'd like for you to highlight some of today's major scientific and health challenges. Would you elaborate on these challenges? And could you possibly highlight some of the factors that may have contributed to the rise of such challenges?
Sure. Well, first of all, we've made enormous progress in terms of extending longevity in the U.S., now standing at about age 79, whereas in 1900, the average survival was in your 40s. So enormous progress based on the results of research. Look at deaths from heart attack and stroke, which have dropped by 60 or 70% in just the last 40 years, is another example of how we've advanced because of medical research. But of course, that has presented us with additional challenges right now. For instance, with the aging of the population, Alzheimer's disease emerges as a very significant concern, and one where we believe right now there's some exceptional scientific opportunity as well. The obesity crisis, when you look at what's happened to our country, where now 69% of adults are overweight or obese. Just a frightening number, and it's happened relatively quickly over the last 30 years. All the consequences that carries in terms of diabetes and many other complications are likely to take away many of the gains that have been obtained previously in terms of human health, and we urgently need to come up with better ways to give people the tools they need to avoid that future outcome of all of us being overweight. Many other areas of great opportunity but challenge, cancer certainly beginning to yield up a lot of its secrets, but we need to move as fast as we can to try to get those cancer death rates down because there's still far too many people who are stricken with cancers like pancreatic cancer, for instance, or brain cancer, where we don't have the kind of interventions that are as successful as we would like. Those are just a few. I could also point to childhood problems like autism, which is a national concern, and well, it should be given the increasing frequency, and we don't quite understand why that is. I could point to our increasing need to be sure that we're taking advantage of what we know works, like managing hypertension, for instance, but we have still a better need to understand how to implement effective strategies in the real world, and that's another area of priority.
Well, Dr. Collins, what is basic research and how does it differ from applied or translational research? And what are you doing, more importantly, to bridge these aspects of scientific exploration?
NIH spends about 53% of its budget on basic research, and that would be defined as research on some aspect of biological processes that does not have an immediate implication or application to a disease. But you have to understand how life works at the most fundamental level before you can really understand what disease is all about. So this is the foundation of everything we do. And over the course of many decades, the basic science research, which has led to no less than 135 Nobel Prizes for NIH-funded grantees, is the way in which we've often then gotten to the next level of understanding about a biological process, and that in turn has led to insights about disease, which are now making big differences clinically. If we want to continue to see those medical advances going forward 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to be doing the basic science now that is going to provide that foundation.
Dr. Collins, you noted that basic discovery and the development of therapies go hand in hand at NIH, and that these two types of research have and always will exist together in a continuum. Would you highlight just a few areas in which basic research advances are opening up new translational opportunities?
Well, for instance, basic science trying to understand at the fundamental level what are the causes of various rare diseases. Rare diseases collectively affect about 26 million Americans, and there are about 7,000 of these rare diseases. In the space of just the last 10 years, we've uncovered, using basic science strategies, the molecular basis of about 4,700 of those diseases. Just breathtaking, the rate at which this insight has been coming forward. Of course, that's useful in terms of getting a grasp on what the diseases are all about, but what you really want is to translate that into an intervention. Only about 250 of those diseases currently have any treatment at all. By having now made those basic discoveries, we're poised to be able to translate that into action. And that is, in fact, a major focus of a new center at NIH, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. There are a number of steps that you want to follow once you understand the molecular basis of a disease. They're complicated, they're failure-prone, they're risky. But we know increasingly how to do that. And that's a great example of how, at the present time, the basic science informs the translation. I should say, this is also a virtuous circle, that when you make an observation at the basic level that leads you to clinical insight, sometimes when you try this out clinically, you learn something about the basics as well, and you go around that virtuous circle to your benefit over and over again.
Well, Dr. Collins, could you give us a sense of the complex process you just alluded to? What are some of the key steps so our listeners understand a little bit more?
Sure. Maybe I'll use an example, and I'll pick an example actually from my own research lab because I continue to run a lab here at NIH. We're studying the rarest form of premature aging, a condition called progeria, which affects children who age at about 7 times the normal rate and sadly usually die by age 12 or 13 from heart attacks or strokes. And at that point, they look like little old people who have aged very rapidly. Basic science led us to discover the cause of that 9 years ago. But now following up on that, additional basic science helped us understand why a single DNA letter out of 3 billion that was misspelled was capable of causing this multi-system disease and suggested something we could do about it. There are now 28 kids with progeria. It's such a rare disease, it's hard to find more than that, who've been on a clinical trial for 4 years with a drug that we believe has all the right properties to help them. And we're watching closely to see how that goes with some encouraging signs. That drug was actually developed not for progeria, but for cancer. But it turns out it has the right properties to affect the pathway that we know needs some tweaking for these kids with this disease. Along the way, we've learned things by studying the clinical disease of progeria that are teaching us interesting aspects of the normal process of aging, something that all of us, including you and I, have in our future. So it's a great example of this basic to clinical, back to basic.
So how do you see the balance between basic science and translational research evolving into the future?
I think we will continue at NIH to have about the same balance we do now, roughly 50-50 of basic and translational. I think I said basic is 53% right now. I don't imagine it changing much from that. We are at NIH the major supporter of basic biomedical research. The translational and clinical efforts, of course, do go on also in the private sector, and well, they should. And we work closely to be sure that what we do in that arena is complementary and not competitive with the private sector. But the private sector is not going to do the basic research that's not connected to a product. It's really NIH's job to do that. We take that very seriously. We don't intend to diminish that responsibility.
Dr. Collins, despite huge investments in biomedical science and technology, the number of new drugs approved per $1 billion of R&D research has been cut in half every 9 years since 1950. I found that fascinating. To tackle this problem, you propose the creation of the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS. Would you elaborate on the mission of the center? What are some of the key ways it will enhance the development of drugs and diagnostics?
Well, you point out correctly that if you look at the efficiency of producing new drugs and getting them approved for general application, it's a very scary-looking series of trends. A recent publication, perhaps it's the one you're citing, looked at this. It almost looks as if there's some law of physics going on here where year after year, the productivity of the enterprise is dropping in a constant fashion. This is sort of the opposite of what you would expect. Where a lot of dollars are going into this, a lot of new science has become possible, you would think we'd be getting better at this. In fact, the authors of that article, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, decided to name this with a name of a law, picking up on the Moore's Law for computers, which says things always get better. They called this Eroom's Law, which is Moore written backwards, to emphasize how backwards this whole scene is. So we've got a big problem here. We have all these diseases for which treatments are desperately needed. We have these fantastic explosion of insights on the basic science front about what causes these illnesses, and yet somehow things aren't getting through the pipeline. So NCATS, this National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, was very much founded on the need to try to identify what are those systematic bottlenecks that caused this process to be so challenging. And it is. The average time it takes to go from a good idea about a new treatment to getting that drug approved is 14 years. The failure rate is well over 99%. Now, an engineer looking at a pipeline like that would say, come on, there must be something better you could do here to improve success and shorten the time. And that's what NCATS aims to do, to look systematically, in a way that no single project focus would achieve. Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the things where we lose momentum, where time goes by more than it should, where failure rates are way too high? Could we take some of the new science that's coming forward in the last few years and really re-engineer that pipeline? That's what we're trying to do.
So, Doctor, as a follow-up, would you tell us more about your collaboration with the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, in advancing the field of regulatory science? How does the formation of the NIH-FDA Joint Leadership Council factor into such an effort?
It's very important. Peggy Hamburg and I, shortly after we were both appointed to our roles at FDA and NIH, formed this council and agreed that we would personally co-chair it. The idea being to try to identify from both the agency's perspective, how could we move more quickly to get safe and effective treatments in the hands of patients, building on the science that's now possible. I'll just give you one example where we're working with FDA on a new approach to try to identify when you have a promising drug that you think might be the next big thing for cancer or diabetes, how do you know whether it's going to be safe? There comes that moment where you have to decide whether or not that drug can be given to the first human patient. Right now, the way we test that is to give that same drug to some small animals, some large animals, at increasing doses. We look to see if there's any evidence of toxicity. And it's a system that's slow and expensive and not very reliable, unfortunately. Animals just aren't the same as we are. The new approach, which we're working on both with FDA and with the Department of Defense in their DARPA program, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, is to load human cells representing various organ types onto a biochip and to wire them up with readouts that will tell you whether those cells are happy or not when a compound is shown to them. This will allow us to look at human liver, human heart, human kidney, human brain on a biochip in a fashion that we believe should be closer to the action in terms of predicting whether a drug is going to be safe or not, and should also be much faster and cheaper to utilize once the chip is developed. Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun to see how this goes, bringing together the engineering perspective of DARPA, NIH's biological expertise, FDA's intense interest in the regulatory aspects of this to be sure that it's going to hold up well and actually be reliable. And we might be able to completely re-engineer the way that that part of the drug pipeline is currently conducted to the benefit of everybody.
What is NIH doing to advance biomedical research to enhance human life and health? We will ask Dr. Francis Collins, director of NIH, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.